find. Now, apparently, with a dark commanded horse. Hardly, he groaned, sighing in relief as she rose from his side, going to the small chest, holding the various pots and boxes containing her curatives. I suspect my new horse just likes the fight. He had taken a basement room in the one structure left standing in Warnsclave, the harbour master's fortress-like house rising from the base of the mole, entirely built of granite and too substantial to be easily torn down. The queen and her retinue occupied the upper floors, whilst the army made camp amidst the ruins, the ranks swelling yet again as more people trailed in from the surrounding countryside. "Like his master," Derena muttered, making him wince again. This was the first cross word between them since Altor, stirring fears their bond might not be so immune to injury after all. The battle had been brief, hardly surprising given the odds, the Valerians running after no more than a quarter hour of combat, the time it took to cut down the Varitai. The surviving free swords fled in all directions, soon hunted down by the Airhill, whilst the Nilsalians finished off the wounded and engaged in the time-honoured soldier's treat of looting the dead. To his surprise, Valin was greeted with grave respect as he walked the field, soldiers offering bows and raised lances in salute. "Do they choose not to see?" he wondered, preferring to believe in a man of foolish courage and a dark-led horse rather than the weakened fool who can't stay in the saddle and drops his sword. "I came close to dying today," he told her, his tone flat, reflective. She didn't turn, but her back stiffened. "You know I lost my song," he went on, "when you brought me back. Without it, I dropped my sword, Derena." She turned, a frown of anger on her face. "Is that self-pity I hear, my lord?" "No," he shook his head, "just honest words." "Well, I have some honest words for you." She came to him, kneeling to clasp his hands, small, slender fingers working to clasp his own. "I once saw a boy fight like a savage to win a banner in some dreadful game. I thought it cruel then. In truth, I still do. But the boy I saw that day did not hear a note from his song. Otherwise, I would have felt it. You were always more than your gift." She took a firmer grip on his hands. "A gift is not muscle, or bone, or a skill learned since boyhood. A skill I cannot believe has dulled in but a few weeks." She raised her gaze. The anger faded now as she stood, releasing his hands to enfold his head, pulling him close. "We both have much still to do, Valin, and I believe our queen's purpose would be better served with you at her side." She moved back, smiling down at him, her smooth, warm hand tracing from his brow to his chin, before placing a kiss on his lips. "Did you happen to find a key for this door?" Later she lay with her head resting on his chest, her small and perfect form pressed against him, dispelling any vestige of the chill. It had begun at Altor with scarcely any word spoken that first night. There had been no preamble, just silent and unabashed need, as they coiled together in the dark, drawn together by something neither felt any inclination to resist. "The queen hates me," she whispered now, her breath ruffling the hairs on his chest. "She strives to hide it, but I can feel it. Whereas I can only suspect it," he thought. "We break no law and offer no insult," he said. "And even a queen is allowed her own feelings. You and her. When you were young, did you—" He gave a faint chuckle. "No. Such a thing could never have happened." His smile faded as Linda Nalhestian's face came to mind, so many years on, and still the guilt of it cut him. "She loves you," Derena went on. "You must see it." "I see only the queen I am bound to follow. Best for all if I see nothing more." "What do the Sjorda say of her?" He felt her tense, her head shifting on his chest. "Nothing, to me, that is. What they say to each other, however, I cannot say." He knew the Sjorda's attitude to them both had undergone a severe transformation since Altor, a deep wariness replacing the affection they held for her, and the reluctant respect they had begun to show him. "What is it?" he asked her. "Why do they fear us so?" She remained silent for a long time, eventually raising herself up to rest her chin on her hands. her face hidden in the dark, but her eyes catching the light from the small opening in the basement wall. Like the faithful, the Shura do not see death as a curse, but they believe when a soul takes leave of the body, it goes not to a world beyond this, but to a hidden place, a world that exists in every shadow and dark corner, unseen and unknowable by living eyes. In this world, you take every lesson learned when alive, every hunter's trick or warrior's skill, every scrap of lore, and you embark upon the great and endless hunt. But free of fear or uncertainty, every burden carried in life gone, leaving only the hunt. You may have seen them in the forest sometimes, reaching a hand into the shadowed hollow of a tree or the shade cast by a rock, hoping for a whispered message from a loved soul lost to the hunt. "When you brought me back," he said, "you deprived me of a gift. The greatest gift. You should talk to them. Tell them the truth of it." "I did. It didn't help. In their eyes I am a transgressor, and you should no longer be walking this earth. They are lost to me now." He held her as she lowered her gaze once more, playing his hands over her shoulders and feeling her sorrow. "Then why do they stay?" he asked. Her reply was soft, sighed through tears. "They do what we do. Heed the wolf's call." Reva's sword thumped against his bruised side, drawing a pain-filled grunt. She hopped nimbly backwards as he answered, with a clumsy upward slash, then lunged forward in a crouch, jabbing a thrust at his chest. He dodged away, flicking her wooden blade up, and Emir cut at her legs, which struck home as she waited too long to form the parry. "Better," she said, "don't you think?" Valin moved to the nearby tree stump where his canteen sat, drinking deep. The sky was overcast today and the air chilled, heralding the onset of autumn and the prospect of a less than easy march to Varenshold. They had lingered at Warrensclave for 3 days now, as they waited for the Meldinian fleet to appear. The supply situation had been alleviated by Lord Albera's provisions, but they still lacked sufficient stocks to sustain the northward advance, especially in light of their ever-growing number of recruits. Over 1,000 people had made their way to the ruined city since their arrival, forcing the addition of yet more companies to Norta's regiment. The Valerians, it seemed, hadn't been quite so efficient as they imagined in gathering slaves, though scouts brought daily evidence of their proficiency in slaughter, telling tales of one ruined village after another, each well-stocked with rotting corpses. "No," he told Reva. "If anything, I'm worse today." He tossed his canteen aside and charged at her, delivering a rapid series of thrusts and slashes, his wooden sword moving in a blur. She dodged and parried with a fluency that put her early lessons to shame. Battle-honed skill always counted for more, he knew. He also knew she was going easy on him, allowing him to land strokes she could have easily blocked, making her replies just fractionally slower than they should have been. "This won't do," he muttered, pulling up short from another lunge. "Oh, come now," she mocked. "Not giving up, are you?" "You love me too much," he thought with an inward sigh, "scared to watch me die again." He cast his gaze at the field below the hill where they practiced. The army laboring under the instruction of officers and sergeants, new recruits and old being honed into their queen's deadly instrument of justice. He could see her cantering along on her white horse, black cloak trailing in the wind, raising salutes and exhortations wherever she rode. "Do you—" Reva had come to a stand beside him, speaking in hesitant tones. "What?" he prompted. "The queen." Reva's eyes tracked Lerna's horse as she trotted towards Norta's new companies, people falling to the knees as she came to a halt. "What was done to her? Do you ever wonder what it might mean?"
"Her healing?"
"No, not her healing. What was done before. To suffer what she suffered. Healed or not, the scars run deep."
"As deep as yours, sister?"
"Perhaps deeper. That's what worries me.
My hands are red, as are yours. We have no claim to innocence, and I'll answer to the father when my time comes.
But she? Sometimes I think she would burn the whole world if it meant the death of the last Valerian. And even then she wouldn't be sated."
"Don't you hunger for justice?" Justice, yes. And to make my people secure once more. To do that, I'll fight her war and free her city. But that won't be enough, will it? What will you tell her when she orders you to follow her across the ocean? No song, no guidance, just ever more silent uncertainty. Thank you for the practice, my lady, he said, turning to offer a bow. But I think I need a less caring tutor. Devon's ash sword batted Valen's parry aside and cracked against his unarmored ribs, leaving him winded and doubled over. Devon stepped back as Valen gasped for air, glaring up at him. "Who told you to stop, Sergeant?" The former shipwright gave a momentary frown, which quickly transformed into a bright-toothed grin, lunging forward to deliver a jab at Valen's nose. He twisted, the ash blade missing by a whisker, grabbing the sergeant's arm and throwing him over his shoulder. Devon was quick to recover, leaping to his feet and whirling to deliver a roundhouse slash at Valen's legs. Wood cracked as Valen blocked the blow, then replied with a series of two-handed strokes aimed at chest and head, the sergeant backing away and blocking every blow, deaf to the calls of the onlookers. 3 days now, and Valen had yet to land a blow, drawing a larger crowd with each repeated bout of practice. Devon, as expected, had needed little persuasion to fight with the Battle Lord, his evident delight increasing further when Valen's reduced skills became apparent. It would have been easy to do this away from the eyes of the army, but Valen resisted the temptation, finding the scrutiny of so many critical eyes a useful impetus to greater effort. He was improving, he could feel it. The chill not so deep now. But still, the sword felt strange in his hand. The once sublime artistry replaced with workmanlike efficiency. How much was the song? He wondered continually. How much do I need it? Devon ducked under another stroke, jerking to the side, then delivering a precise thrust that found its way past Valen's guard to jab into his upper lip, drawing blood and making him reel backwards. Apologies, my lord, Devon said, his sword smacking into Valen's right leg and sending him to the ground, slapping his feeble counterstroke away and raising his weapon for a no doubt painful final blow. But you did say to display no restraint. That's enough! Alornis was striding forward, face red with fury. She shoved a smirking Davin aside and knelt by Valen, pressing a clean rag to his bleeding lip. This is over, she told the sergeant. Go back to your regiment. "Does your lady sister command here now, my lord?" Devon asked Valen. "Perhaps she should." "Sergeant." The voice was soft, but Davin's smirk disappeared in an instant. Norta stood nearby, casting his eye about the onlooking soldiers, mostly free fighters from his own regiment, all quickly finding somewhere else to be. Snowdance moved from Norta's side to nudge at Valen's shoulder, purring insistently until he got to his feet. "Your man is a brute," Alornis told Norta, continuing to staunch the blood flowing from Valen's lip. "Merely following his lordship's order, teacher," Davin said to Norta. Whereas he showed a complete absence of fear in regard to Valen, his attitude to Norta was always markedly more respectful. "Indeed he was," Valen said, pausing to hawk a red glob onto the ground. "And very well, too, I might add." Norta spared Davin a brief glance. "See to the pickets," he ordered quietly. The sergeant bowed and hurried off. "A thousand things can happen in a battle," Norta said to Valen. "You put too much stock in one dropped sword." "Wars aren't won with dropped swords, brother." Valen took the rag from Alornis and walked towards the tree where he had tethered Scar. "Brother Kellen should see to that," she called after him, but he just waved and climbed into the saddle. Finding Canis wasn't difficult. The Seventh Order contingent, now grown to some 4 brothers and 2 sisters, were housed in a canvas-roofed ruin near the harbour, somewhat removed from the rest of the army, who continued to eye them with unabashed suspicion. Canis sat with the others, talking in low but earnest tones, each of them listening with keen attention. They were all younger than his brother. The gift of youth provided a greater chance of surviving the Valerian onslaught. the young being better suited to the rigours of battle, or more likely to catch the slaver's eye. One young man had clearly endured some harsh treatment, sitting shirtless as he listened to Canis, his back striped with recent whip strokes, raw and red in the evening light. "The province of war is no longer confined to the Sixth Order," Canis was saying. "Now all the faithful are called to join this struggle. Now we are all warriors. Concealment is a luxury we can no longer afford." He fell silent as Valen stepped from the shadows, the others turning to regard him with a mixture of customary awe and grave respect. "Brother," Valen said, "I would speak with you." They walked the length of the mole as darkness fell, a three-quarters moon showing through intermittent cloud. Canis said nothing, waiting for him to speak, perhaps fully aware of the first word he would say. "Mikkel," Valen said when they had come to the end of the mole. The evening tide had drawn the sea back from the mole, so it seemed they stood atop a great height. Assailed by a strong breeze, the gently lapping waves barely visible below. He searched Canis's face, as his brother gave no response, seeing what he had expected to see. Guilt. "Before I sailed to the Reaches, Aspect Greenlin assured me he had no part in it," Valen went on, "placing the blame squarely on Brother Harlech, who in truth has admitted his part, though not in the most fulsome terms. Is there perhaps something you would like to add to the story, brother?" Kenny's expression didn't change, and his voice toneless as he replied, "My Aspect instructed me to keep you safe. I did as I was instructed. The men who killed Mikkel told of another, someone I fancy they met in the forest that night, someone they feared. They were expecting a brother of Harlech's acquaintance, someone complicit in his scheme. I found him, killed him, and took his place. The assassins hired by Norta's father were not so easily killed, so I sent them in the wrong direction, a direction I expected would lead them clear of any brothers. Mikkel, however, was always so slow and so easily lost." Valen turned away from him, staring out to sea. The wind was rising, and the wave tops shone white in the dim moonlight. Farther out he could see a black shape on the horizon, soon joined by several more. "Our fleet lord makes good his promise," he observed. Canis glanced at the approaching ships. "This war has garnered some strange allies, and revealed much in the process. That day you found us, my words were unfair. I had lost so many men, so much unforeseen death. It seemed the departed had abandoned us, as if your faithlessness had drawn their judgment. It was a foolish notion, brother." "Brother," Valen repeated softly, "we've called each other that for so long, I wonder if it still holds meaning. So much has been concealed, so many lies spoken. That first day, in the vaults, Greenlin patted you on the shoulder and you flinched. I thought you feared his imaginary rats, but he was greeting you. You weren't joining the Sixth Order. You were reporting to your Aspect. It is how we persist, how we continue to serve the faith. At least until now. With Aspect Greenlin gone, the burden of rebuilding this order falls to me. It would sit easier with your help. The gifted from the Reaches want no part of your order. Kara and Markan aren't even of the faith, and I doubt Lorcan could summon the will to believe in anything." "Much like you, brother." Kenneth's words were softly spoken, but Valen heard the judgment in them clearly. "I did not lose my faith," he told Kenneth. "It shriveled and died in the face of truth." "And will this great truth win this war, brother? Look around you, and see how many have suffered. Will your truth sustain them in the months and years ahead? Will your gift? I've yet to learn what manner of power you hold, and if I'm to command this army, I should greatly like to know." Canis stood regarding him in silence, eyes intent and unblinking. Valen's hand went to the hunting knife at his belt, gripping the handle tight, ready to draw it forth, stab it into his brother's eye. He breathed out slowly, releasing the knife and finding his hand trembling. "So now you know, brother," Canis said before turning and walking away.
Chapter 7. Eleusis. Aspect Dendrish sagged on hearing the news, seeming to shrink as his bulk subsided onto his too narrow bed. His jowls shimmered as he worked his slug-like lips, brow drawn in a frown of despair.
There.
He paused and swallowed, gazing up at Eleusis with wide-eyed desperation. There could be some error in this, some misunderstanding.
I doubt that, Aspect, Eleusis said. It seems Master Greelin has truly met his end, though in rather strange circumstances.
He went on to relate the tale Darnell had told him, complete with the dark powers attributed to the fallen master of the Sixth Order. Dendrish's response was swift, immediate, and far too practiced to be anything but a lie.
Utter nonsense. In fact, I am appalled a man of learning could lend any credence to such lurid piffle.
Quite so, Aspect. Eleusis fished inside his sack and brought out a fresh volume, tossing it onto the bed. One of his more prized finds, Brother Killen's The Voyage of the Swift Wing. He had intended to annoy the Aspect with an annotated copy of Lord Al-Avern's Complete and Unbiased History of the Church of the World Father, but felt the plump scholar's spirits might be in need of a lift. Dendrish, however, didn't even glance at the book, sitting and staring at nothing as Eleusis begged leave and departed the cell. Aspect Alera was more careful in her response, commenting briefly about her scant acquaintance with the late master before expressing her deep appreciation for the fresh medicine and new books. Her tone, however, became markedly more intent when she asked him, "And the wine, Eleusis?"
"I have yet to seek it out, Aspect."
She met his gaze, speaking in a surprisingly harsh whisper.
"Then be sure to slake your thirst soon, good sir."
With Darnell and much of the Renfalen knights gone off to hunt down the elusive Red Brother, Varenshold was even more quiet than usual. Most of the Valerian garrison were Varitai, never particularly talkative, and the smaller contingent of free swords kept to themselves in the northern quarter mansion houses they had transformed into barracks. The streets, such as they were, remained unpatrolled for the most part, since there was hardly a soul left to police. Most slaves had been shipped across the ocean weeks ago, and those that remained were fully occupied fulfilling Darnell's vision of his great palace, one in particular providing the most valued labour, so valued, in fact, that Darnell had threatened to sever the hand of any overseer who touched him with the slightest kiss of a whip. Visiting Master Benrel was not one of Eleusis's favourite obligations, a task to be undertaken as infrequently as his conscience allowed, usually when images of Alornis loomed largest in his mind. He found the old master hard at work on the western wall, a ragged and burnt eyesore in the aftermath of the city's fall, marking the apex of the palace's destruction, now covered in fresh marble from end to end. Benrel was accompanied by a portly, balding slave, older than most but spared execution by virtue of his skill with stone, and his expert knowledge of where to find more. He rarely spoke more than a few words, the overseers having been given no injunction about applying the whip to his back, but revealed the highborn's cultured vowels when he did. Eleusis had yet to learn the man's name, and in truth avoided doing so. Slaves could never be relied upon to live long enough to make any association worthwhile.
"Coming along rather nicely, master," he greeted Benrel,
calling up to the second tier of the scaffolding, where the sculptor laboured to craft the great relief depicting Darnell's glorious victory over the Realm Guard. Benrel left off hammering to glance over his shoulder. He offered no greeting, but gave an irritated flick of his hand, granting leave for Eleusis to ascend the ladder. Eleusis always marvelled at the speed with which they worked, the portly slave guiding a rasp over recently completed carvings, as Benrel continued to birth more from virgin stone. Only 1 month into Darnell's vainglorious project, and it was a quarter complete, the finely carved figures emerging from the stone in accordance with the vast cartoon Benrel had unrolled before the fief lord's approving eye.
"Perhaps his greatest work," Eleusis mused, watching Benrel chisel away at the heroic profile of a Renfalen knight in combat with a cringing realm guard. "And it's all a lie." What is it? Benrel asked, leaving off from his carving for a moment, reaching for a nearby earthenware bottle. Merely my regular assurance that both aspects remain alive and unmolested, Aloysius replied. It had been the master's price that day they dragged him before the fief lord, merely raising an eyebrow at Darnell's promises of torture or swift execution, only becoming compliant when his threats turned to the aspects. For all his disdain for custom and propriety, Benrel remained a man of the faith. The master nodded, drinking from the bottle and passing it to the slave. The man cast a cautious eye at 27 before taking a swift drink, returning to his work with determined haste. Aloysius retrieved the bottle, removing the stopper and sniffing the contents. Just water. I hear tell of a hidden stock of wine, he told Benrel, if you would care for some. Wine dulls the senses and makes the mediocre artist imagine himself a great one. Benrel spared him a hard glance before returning to his work. A truism with which you are intimately acquainted, I believe. It has been, as ever, a great pleasure, master. Lucius gave an unheeded bow and returned to the ladder, pausing to cast an eye over Benrel's bony but still strong back, his rope-thin, muscle-knotted arms moving in expert rhythm as they worked the stone. There was one other thing, he added. It seems Master Greelin had taken up with a band of fighters in the forest. You recall Master Greelin? Great fat fellow who minded the Sixth Order's stores. What of it? Benrel asked, continuing to chisel away. Aloysius kept his eyes on Benrel's hands. He died. It was barely a slip, merely the slightest irregularity left in a carving of wondrous execution. But it was too deep to sand away, a timeless testament to a brief lapse of concentration. Many have died, Benrel said, not turning, with many more to come when Lord Alsorna gets here. The portly slave dropped his rasp, casting a fearful glance at 27 before quickly retrieving it. Nearby, one of the overseers turned towards them, his hand going to the coiled whip at his side. "Please have a care, Master Benrel," Aloysius told him. "I take no pleasure in the prospect of describing your death to the woman I love." Benrel still refused to turn, his hands once again moving with the same effortless precision. "Don't you have some wine to find?" It took several attempts before he identified the correct ruin, unearthing a blackened wooden sign from beneath a pile of tumbled brick, the lettering burnt to nothing but the crudely rendered image of a boar visible through the scorching. "Yes," he agreed with 27, "I am fully aware this is probably a fool's errand, thank you. Help me shift this stone." They worked for over an hour before he found it, clearing rubble away from the floorboards to reveal only a faint outline under the dust, a rectangle about a yard square. A bottle or two of wolf's blood would indeed be very welcome, he told 27, wiping the dust away to reveal the hidden entrance, his fingers probing the edges. "Too tight a fit. Use your sword to prise it open." 27 went about the task with his usual unhesitant obedience, jamming his short sword into the edge of the door and levering it up, the strain of the effort plain in the bulge of muscle on his arms, though his face remained as impassive as ever. Aloysius took hold of the edge of the door as it came free, hauling it open all the way, revealing a horizontal drop into blank darkness. He had had the foresight to bring a lamp and lit it now, then lay flat to lower it into the opening, the yellow glow illuminating only a tunnel of rough stone, free of any telltale gleam of glass. "No," he said, shaking his head. "I don't fancy it much either, my friend. But a man must follow his passions, don't you think?" He moved back from the hole and waved at the slave. "You first." 27 stared back and said nothing. "Faith," Aloysius muttered, handing him the lamp. "If I die down there, they'll whip you to death. You know that, I trust." He took hold of the edge of the hole and lowered himself in, hanging from his fingertips, then dropping into the blackness below, finding the air musty and stale. 27 landed nimbly at his side a second later, the lamplight illuminating a tunnel of uninviting length. "There best be some Cumbrelian red at the end of this," Lucius said. "Otherwise I shall be forced to say some very harsh words to Aspect Alera. Some very harsh words indeed." They followed the tunnel for no more than the span of a few minutes. Though the echoing footfalls and absolute dark beyond the limits of the lamp's meagre glow made it seem considerably longer, as did Aloysius's growing conviction that there was no wine to be found here. "I don't care what you insist upon," he hissed at 27. "I will not simply turn back now." Finally, the tunnel opened out into a broad circular chamber, Aloysius drawing up short at the fine brickwork contrasting with the rough stone walls of the tunnel. The chamber was ringed by 7 stone pillars and shallow steps descending to a flat base in the center of which stood a long table. Aloysius went to the table, playing the lamp over the surface and finding it free of dust. "On second thoughts," he said, "perhaps you have a—" A sudden whisper of disturbed air, and the lamp shattered in his hand, flaming oil scattering onto the stone before blinking out, darkness descending with dreadful speed. Aloysius heard 27's sword scrape free of its scabbard, then nothing. No clash of steel or grunt of pain, just the darkness and the silence. "I—" he began, swallowed and tried again. "I don't suppose you have any wine?" Something cold and hard pressed against his neck, positioned precisely above the vein he knew would see him dead in a few heartbeats, should it suffer even a small puncture. "Aspectalera," Aloysius said in a rapid exhalation. "She sent me." A pause, then the blade disappeared from his neck. "Sister," a female voice said, smooth and cultured, but also hard and clipped. "Light the torches. Brother, don't kill the other one just yet." Aloysius Alhestian, the young woman regarded him from across the table with a steady and not especially welcoming expression. "I've read your poems. My master thought them the finest works of modern Australian verse." "Clearly a man of some taste and education," Aloysius replied, casting a furtive glance at 27, crouched into a fighting stance, his sword moving back and forth in a slow parody of combat. On either side of him stood a man and a woman, both young like the woman seated at the table. The woman was plump and short, with a large rat perched on her shoulder. The man was taller, well-built, and wearing a heavily besmirched city guard uniform. The plump woman regarded Aloysius with a faint smile, whilst the guardsman ignored him, staring fixedly at 27 and his slothful swordplay. "Actually," the young woman at the table said, "I found them cloyingly sentimental and overly florid." "Must have been my early work," Aloysius said, turning back to her. Her face was finely featured, a narrow aquiline nose and a softly pointed chin, her hair a pleasing shade of honey blonde, and her eyes set in a cold stare of hostile appraisal. "Your father's a traitor, poet," she stated. "My father is forced to hateful duty by his love for me," he returned. "Kill me if you would have him abandon it." "How noble!" The young woman spread her fingers on the table, where a line of small steel darts were arranged in a neat arc. "And a wish easily granted, should I find you less than honest." The plump woman came forward, her rat running the length of her arm to jump onto the tabletop, scurrying over to Aloysius, snout raised to sniff at his sleeve. "Don't smell a lion his sweat," she advised the young woman in coarse, street-born tones. "My sweat?" Aloysius asked, feeling a fresh trickle of it trace down his back. "Liar's sweat's got a sting to it," the plump woman advised. "Beyond us, but Blacknose here smells it well enough." She extended her hand, and the rat trotted over to her, jumping into her arms and settling into a contented huddle. The dark, Aloysius thought. How delighted Lerna would have been to see this. He forced the thought away. Remembrance of Lerna was painful, and likely to provoke distracting grief at a time when he should be focused on continued survival. "Who are you people?" he asked the young woman. She stared back in silence for a moment, then raised her left hand, the fingers flat and level. She blinked, and one of the darts rose from the table, hovering no more than an inch from her index finger. "Ask another question," she said, "and this goes in your eye." "Can we move this along, sister?" the guardsman said in a strained voice. "This one's mind is easily clouded, but I can't do it forever." The young woman blinked again, and the dart slowly descended to the table. She clasped her hands together, her eyes unwavering from Lucius. "Aspect Alera sent you?"
"Yes."
"What is her condition?"
"She resides in the Black Hold. Unharmed, save a raw ankle and sore need of a bath."
"What did she tell you of us?"
"That you had wine."
Lucius risked a glance around the chamber. "I'm guessing she lied about that."
"She did," the young woman replied. "We also have scant food or water remaining, and our forays into the city above yield us nothing."
"I can bring food. Medicine, too.
Should you need it."
"I assume that was her true purpose in sending me."
He paused to draw breath.
"In sending me to the Seventh Order." The young woman angled her head, mouth twisting in a sardonic smile.
"You speak of legends, poet."
"Oh, what difference do it make now?" the plump woman said, moving to stand behind her sister. "You've got the right of it, your lordship. I'm Sister Inella, she's Sister Cressia, and that over there is Brother Relkin. All that remains of the Seventh Order in this fair city." Lucius gestured at their surroundings.
"And this place?"
"Once a temple to the orders," Sister Cressia replied. "Built before such frippery was expunged from the faith. Our brothers in the Sixth Order found it some years ago. A hide for criminals, subsequently put to better purpose." Lucius turned to obtain a better view of 27 and Brother Relkin, noting the strain on the guardsman's face as the slave continued to move his sword as if through treacle. "What is he doing to him?"
"Making him see what he needs him to see," Cressia said. "We found it's their principal weakness. Those like him and his less deadly cousins. Minds so empty are easily clouded. He thinks he's fighting a horde of assassins, come to spill your blood. Brother Relkin can also control the speed of the vision, making it last an hour or a second."
"But not," Relkin added through gritted teeth, "forever." Lucius turned back to Cressia.
"Food and water," he said. "What else do you need?"
"News of the war would be welcome." "The Valerian fleet sent to the Maldinian Isles suffered some form of calamitous defeat. Tokrev is poised to take Altor, and Darnell has ridden out with his knights to hunt down the Red Brother."
"Lord Alsorna?"
Lucius shook his head. "No word as yet." Cressia sighed and rose from the table.
"When will you return?"
2 days, if you can wait that long. Gathering extra provisions without raising suspicion takes time. She nodded at 27.
"Should we kill this one?"
"His only task is to protect me or kill me, should I step outside the city. In all other regards, he is blind and dumb."
She nodded.
"I'm trusting you because Aspect Alera would not have sent you without reason." She opened a pouch at her belt, and the darts on the table rose to balance on their blunt ends before arching into the pouch in a precise sequence, making Lucius smile at the elegant impossibility of it.
"The night the city fell," Cressia added, "I lost count of the men I killed with these, and other things besides. I bled myself white with killing, and would have died if my sister hadn't found me and brought me here. Know well, poet, if you abuse our trust, I'll drain every drop of blood in my body to kill you."
He found his father at the gate to the North Road, deep in council with the Valerian Division commander, as a battalion of free swords labored to dig a deep ditch behind the wall.
"Lamp oil?" the Valerian was asking as Lucius approached, halting at a respectful distance, though still close enough to hear their discussion.
"As much as you can gather," Lacryl Alhestian replied. "Enough to fill this ditch from end to end." The Valerian looked at the map spread out before them, scanning the lines depicting the walls and the country beyond. Lucius indulged some faint hope the man had enough arrogance to disregard his father's counsel. But sadly, he again proved himself no fool.
"Very well," he said. "Have you chosen where to site the engines?"
Lucius's father pointed to several points on the map as the Valerian nodded approval.
"However," Lacryl said, "I will of course need engines to site."
"They will be here in 30 days, the division commander assured him, "together with 1,000 varitae and 300 more curitae. The council has not abandoned us."
If Lacryl Alhestian took any comfort from the man's words, He failed to show it. An army can travel far in 30 days, he said, especially an army fueled by love of a resurrected queen. Aloysius stifled his gasp, lest it draw the Valerian's anger, his heart hammering worse than in the darkness below the ruined inn. She lives? Mervax straightened, fixing his father with a hard glare. A lie told by cowards seeking to excuse failure, he stated in unequivocal tones. And that's what you'll tell your king when he returns. Whoever leads this rabble is not your queen. His father replied only with the slightest of nods. Aloysius had yet to see him bow to any Valerian. The division commander gave him a final glare and turned to march away, his aides scurrying to keep up. Aloysius approached his father with his heart still pounding. Queen? He asked. So it's said. Alhestian didn't look up from the map. Restored to life, and apparently beauty by dark means. If it's really her, I'd not put it past Alsorna to find a double somewhere and make her a figurehead. Valen too? And if he comes, then so too does Alornis. What of Tokrev? Altor? Killed and saved. A messenger arrived from Warnsclave this morning. It seems every man in Tokrev's army lies slaughtered, and a great army marches north at the word of a dark-blessed queen. My son, it seems you are shortly to be provided an ending to your poem. Aloysius took breath, turning from the map to look at the free swords labouring in the ditch. Aren't ditches normally dug outside the walls? They are, his father replied. And if time allows, I'll dig one there too, for the sake of appearances. The real defence is here. He tapped the map with the barbed spike protruding from his right sleeve, and Aloysius saw an intricate web of black lines tracing through the maze of streets, streets that no longer existed. A series of barriers, choke points, fire traps, and so on. Alsorna's cunning enough, but he can't work miracles. This city will be his army's grave. My lord, Aloysius spoke softly, moving to his father's side. I beg you. We have spoken on this matter already. His father's tone was absolute, implacable. I lost one son. I'll not lose another. Aloysius recalled the night the city fell, the screams and the flames waking him from drunken slumber, stumbling downstairs to find his father in the main hall, surrounded by curatai, slashing madly with his sword as they circled, one already dead, but they made no move to kill him. Aloysius had stood frozen in shock as a meaty arm closed over his neck and the short sword pressed into his temple. A free sword officer shouted to his father, pointing to Aloysius. The expression on his face as he straightened from the fight was hard to forget. Not shame, not despair, just honest and desperate fear for a loved son. 30 days, Aloysius said softly, moving away, hugging himself tight. Winterfall Eve is in 30 days, is it not? Yes, Alhestian said, after a moment's thought. Yes, I suppose it is. Aloysius felt his father's eyes on him, knowing they were heavy with concern. Do you need anything, Aloysius? Some more food, he said. Aspect Dendrish threatens to hang himself if we don't feed him more. Though I doubt the bedsheets will hold him. I'll see to it. Aloysius turned back, his smile bright, heart beat steady now the weight of indecision had lifted. Thank you, my lord. He was walking away when a commotion rose at the gate, the Varitai guards parting to allow entry to a lone rider. Aloysius judged him as one of Darnell's hunters, in truth a bunch of rogues and cutthroats recruited from the dregs of Renfail to hunt down the Red Brother. The man sagged in his saddle as he rode towards Aloysius's father, foam on his horse's flanks and mouth. He nearly collapsed on dismounting, sketching a bow and speaking words too faint for Aloysius to hear, though from the way his father straightened on hearing them, clearly of some import. Alhestian strode off, barking orders, his two curatai guards in tow, Aloysius hearing the word cavalry before he disappeared from view. First a risen queen, and now a need for cavalry. Aloysius mused aloud to 27.
I believe it's time to say goodbye to an old friend. Blue Feather delivered a painful nip at his thumb as he lifted her clear of the coop, the message dangling from her leg. So much weight on such a fragile thing, Lucius thought, eyeing the thin wire clasp. Do you want to say goodbye to her? He asked 27, who as ever said nothing. Oh, ignore him, he told Blue Feather. I'm going to miss you. He held her up and opened his hands. She sat there for a moment, seemingly uncertain, then leapt free, her wings a blur as she ascended, then flattened out to catch the wind and fly away south. Winterfall Eve, Lucius thought as he lost sight of the bird. When it's said, all grievances are forgiven. For who wants to bear a grudge through the hardships of winter? Chapter 8. Frentis. A stiff autumn wind played over the remnants of the Urlish, raising swirling columns of ash to sting eyes and choke throats. It stretched away on either side of them, a dirty grey blanket covering the earth, broken only by the occasional black spike of a once mighty tree. Would have thought some of it might have survived, Erman said, hawking and spitting before tying a scarf about his face. Darnell was certainly thorough, Bander said. Marching across this will not be pleasant. We could skirt it, Arundel suggested. Head to the coast. The coast road is too narrow, Solis said. Too many choke points, and Alhestian is bound to know them all. And if we maintain this course, Banders replied, the dust trail we raise will give him ample signal of our approach, not to mention filling our lungs with this stuff. The country to the west is more open, Solis admitted, but we'll add another week to our march. Frentis stifled a groan at the prospect of more days spent dreading dream-filled nights. Varenshold had become a focus for his desire, for an ending, an ever-growing hope that whatever the outcome of their assault, he would at least be assured release from her. Can't be helped, brother. Bandis turned his horse about, nodding to Ermund. Spread the word. We turn west until we clear the ash. It was there again, Ilion said at breakfast, smiling thanks at 34 as he handed her a bowl of his honey-sweetened porridge. What was there? Arundel asked. The wolf. I've seen it every day for a week now. Throw stones, Devoka suggested. Wolf will run from stones. Not this one. He's so big I doubt he'd feel them. Anyway, he's not scary. Doesn't chase after me or growl or anything. Just sits and watches. Frentis saw discomfort in Devoka's expression as she watched the girl eat her porridge. I come with you today, she said. See if he watches me. Ilion scowled, speaking a labored but precise Lonak phrase he knew translated as, the coddled cub never hunts. Devoka gave a soft laugh and returned to her own meal, though Frentis saw her lingering disquiet. I'll come too, he said, keen to seek out any distraction from the persistent stain of last night's dream. It had been stranger than usual, a confused jumble of images, mostly violent, often full of pain and sorrow, but not always. She whimpers as she lies abed, staring at her bedroom door. She laughs as she strangles a woman beneath her desert sky. She shudders in pleasure as he moves in her, heart swelling with feelings she had thought long dead. On waking, sweating and striving to quell a torrent of sensation, he realized he had not seen her waking hours, but her dreams. I dream her dreams. What does she dream of me? They rode west until midday, finding nothing save empty fields and the occasional cluster of slaughtered cattle or sheep, mostly older animals, the younger ones, no doubt, having been herded off to Varenshold. Another mile's ride brought them to an empty farmhouse, the roof gone and walls blackened by fire, no sign of any life within. Why do they destroy so much? Ilion asked. They take slaves, which is evil but at least comprehensible. But to tear down everything whilst doing so? It's beyond reason. They think they're cleansing the land, Frentis told her, wiping it clean so their own people can start anew. build another province to the Empire in its image. Ilion pulled her horse to a halt an hour later, turning to Devoka and pointing to a nearby rise, her smile bright.
There. Isn't he beautiful?
Frentis found it quickly, a shadowed outline on the skyline, taller than any wolf he had seen before. It sat regarding them with impassive scrutiny as they trotted closer, Devoka resting her spear on her shoulder for a quick throw. They stopped some 30 yards short of the beast, close enough for Frentis to see its eyes, blinking as it looked at each of them in turn, fur ruffling in the wind. He saw the plain truth in Ilion's words. It was beautiful. The wolf rose and turned, moving off towards the north at a brisk trot for 100 paces or so, then stopping once more, sitting and watching as they exchanged glances.
It didn't do this before, Ilion said after a moment.
Devoka muttered something in her own language, face dark with foreboding, but Frentis noticed she had lowered her spear. He turned back to the wolf, seeing how its gaze was fixed entirely on him. He kicked his horse forward, and the wolf rose again to follow its northward course. After a second, he heard Ilion and Devoka spurring to follow. The wolf started to run after a half mile or so, its long, loping stride covering the distance with deceptive speed. Frentis lost sight of it several times as they galloped after, tracking it over low hills of long grass. Finally they reined in as it came to a halt on one of the taller hills, and a familiar scent came to Frentis's nostrils. He raised a questioning eyebrow at Devoka, who nodded and climbed down from the saddle. Frentis joined her, and they handed their reins to Ilion. She pouted in annoyance as he pointed an emphatic finger to the ground to fix her in place. They ascended the hill at the crouch, dropping to a crawl at the summit. The wolf had sunk to its haunches, waiting no more than a few feet away, still regarding Frentis with the same blank scrutiny. "What a fool the man must be," Frentis breathed, staring at the scene before them. The camp sat in open ground, the rear flank covered by a shallow stream, pickets patrolling the perimeter, but not far enough out. The scent of smoke and horse sweat was richer now. Campfires threw dozens of grey columns into the air, only partly obscuring the banner that rose from the centre of the camp. An eagle on a red and white check background. 500 men at most, Frentis mused, eyes scanning the camp. And Banda's army stands unnoticed between him and Varenshold. Take Ilion, he told Devoka. Tell Banders I'll lead them to Lurkhan's Spur. Master Solis knows the way.
She can go, Devoka said. You shouldn't do this alone.
He shook his head, grinning as he nodded at the wolf. Seems I'm not alone. Ride fast. He waited a good hour after their departure, watching the camp as scouts came and went, small groups of men with hunting dogs reporting in or galloping off in a fresh direction. He thought we'd make for Nilsail, Frentis decided, seeing how most of the scouts rode off to the north or the west. Didn't consider we'd try for Renfell, his own land, the people so fiercely loyal. He shook his head, wondering if Darnell's mind was truly that of a fool, or if the man wasn't in fact just a barking loon. It took the best part of another hour before a scouting party came their way, 2 riders and a clutch of dogs making directly for their hill. The wolf rose when they had begun to climb the slope, the riders immediately dragging their mounts to a halt, whilst the hounds milled about, whining in fear as their masters whipped at them, uttering curses and threats. And the wolf howled. Frentis shrank from the vastness of the sound, sinking to the earth, eyes clamped tight shut, and hands over his ears as it soared across the fields and hills, the force of it cutting through him like the ragged saw blade. Not since the long years of the binding had he felt so helpless, so small. He opened his eyes as the howl faded, finding the wolf staring down at him, green eyes meeting his, and birthing a realization that it knew him, knew his every secret, every hidden scrap of guilt. It dipped its head, a rough tongue scraping over Frentis's forehead, drawing a whimper and leaving something new. A message. It wasn't a voice, more a certainty, a clear and bright surety shining in his mind. You must forgive yourself.
Frentis felt a laugh escape him as the wolf drew back, blinked again, then turned to lope away.
Frentis stood to watch it run, a silver streak through the twisting grass, disappearing in a heartbeat.
The whinny of a panicked horse brought him back to his senses, turning to find the two riders staring at him in shock, their dogs a good distance away, yelping in fear as they raced for the camp.
Frentis chose the rider on the left, palmed a throwing knife, and sent it into his throat. He fell from his horse, blood frothing from his mouth as he clutched at his neck. His companion's wide-eyed gaze shifted to Frentis and back again, hands twitching on his reins, his sword untouched at his side.
"You have a report to make," Frentis told him. "Give Lord Darnell the Red Brother's regards."
He remounted and guided his horse to the crest of the hill, sitting and watching as the huntsman galloped back to camp. It took no longer than the space of a few heartbeats before it convulsed, knights struggling into armor and running to their horses, tents falling as squires packed up, and a single rider emerged from the burgeoning dust cloud, blue armor gleaming in the late afternoon sun.
Frentis raised a hand in a friendly wave, lingering long enough to ensure Darnell had seen it, then turned and galloped towards the east. He led them on a winding course, buying time for Bandus to get his people moving. He would gallop east for a time, halt, and watch Darnell's pursuit for a few moments, then strike out towards the south.
Darnell edged closer with every pause, but his horse and those of his knights were too burdened by their rider's armor to mount an effective pursuit.
Frentis would wave every time he stopped, the last time leaving it long enough to ensure Darnell saw his mocking bow.
He came to Lurkin's Spur some 2 hours into the chase, a narrow, thumb-shaped spit of grassland jutting into the broad waters of the Brinewash. The river was shallow here, fordable, even this late in the year, with open country to the north and a tall, rocky hill some 300 paces south, shielding the eastern bank from view.
He pulled his horse to a halt and scanned the surroundings, finding no evidence of an ally.
He turned his horse about, calming him with a stroke to the flank as he waited. The wolf's message still sang in his breast, his newborn spirit leaving him with a faint smile that refused to budge from his lips, even as Darnell's 500 knights thundered towards the spur.
"Come, my lord," he urged Darnell silently, "just a little closer."
His risen spirits took a slight tumble at the sight of Darnell raising a hand, his entire command coming to a halt some 200 paces short.
Frentis reached over his shoulder and drew his sword, raising it high before pointing it directly at Darnell in a clear and unambiguous challenge.
"Be true to yourself, my lord," Frentis implored him. "Be the fool."
Darnell's horse reared as its rider drew his own sword, one of his retainers trotting forward, perhaps keen to offer a cautionary word. But Darnell dismissed him with a furious wave before spurring his horse to a gallop.
Frentis made ready to begin his own charge, then paused as a new sound came to his ears, horns sounding a high pealing note to the east, too high for a Renfalen knight, and the Sixth Order had no use for horns. He paused to glance over his shoulder, his smile fading completely at the sight of at least 2 battalions of Valerian cavalry charging towards the eastern bank of the Brinewash.
"Alhestian," he cursed.
Another tumult drew his attention to the south, the great churning roaring of many horses charging through shallow water.
Banders led his knights around the rocky hill and straight for Darnell's company, Frentis spying the dim figures of his brothers atop the hill, bows drawn.
He switched his gaze back to Darnell, finding the fieflord now halted, his men milling in confusion behind him.
Frentis cast a final look at the onrushing Valerian cavalry, now fording the river, but prevented from galloping by the water's height. He fixed his gaze on Darnell once more, and kicked his horse into motion, sword held out straight and level as he charged, covering the distance in barely a few seconds. He could see the black streaks of his brother's arrows arcing into Darnell's host, horses rearing and knights falling as they struck home. One of Darnell's retainers took hold of the fieflord's reins and tried to drag him towards the Valerians, falling dead as Darnell hacked his longsword into the man's neck, wheeling about and meeting Frentis's charge head-on. Their horses collided with bone-shattering force, Francis's sword rebounding from Darnell's blade as the fieflord slashed at him before the animals reeled back. Francis's horse staggered, snorting foam and blood, sinking to its knees as he leapt